You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the late 1950s, Kent McKenzie set out to make a film that accurately portrayed the lives of Native Americans living in Los Angeles. After several years and just as many title changes, the result was a mix of documentary and story film called The Exiles. Although it was critically acclaimed at the time, it was never given a theatrical release. Until now, 47 years later. The Exiles has been restored by Milestone Films and is presented by Charles Burnett and Sherman Alexie, both of whom join us now, along with Milestone Films co-founder and vice president Dennis Doris. And I'm very pleased to welcome all three of them to this program today. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Let's begin with you, Sherman, because you're the only one who's not in the studio. What does presented by mean?
probably have to ask Dennis that. I think it was a way of, of course, Charles being that amazing director, one of the great directors of our time, of course, we know why he's presenting it. Me, I'm the Indian.
But you've also been involved with films. When did you first see The Exiles?
I saw it in Boston about 10 years ago, and it was the professor's VHS copy of a battered VHS copy of a battered print. So it was almost unwatchable.
So you must be thrilled to see this version, which is just sparkling.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. I watch it on my big TV, and I'll just put it on to have the images playing because it's so gorgeous.
Charles, were you aware of this film when you made Killer of Sheep?
No, unfortunately.
Because they're so similar in spirit.
I wasn't aware of it until Tom Anderson showed me a copy of. He was working on Los Angeles Plays L.A.
What's Los Angeles Plays itself.
And I saw
that was a film in which he showed how Los Angeles had been used for locations in many films. Sometimes as Los Angeles, sometimes as other places.
And I was just struck by the film. It was really something I identified with right away in the style and everything. It wasn't until after I got the notes on the film that I found that we were arriving at the same kind of ideas and notion about filmmaking, and he had did it a lot earlier. I got into film in the late 60s. He had did it in the early 50s.
And your film looks revolutionary. So what about Kent McKenzie? Do you think that The Exiles is a stylistic break from everything before it?
I think so. It's a combination of trying to do a dramatic and a documentary at the same time, in a sense, And I think he managed to do so very well. And the people are so real in the film.
Well, Dennis, he called The Exiles an anti-theatrical and anti-social documentary film. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, it's kind of interesting that when Charles was at UCLA in the 70s, that was the radical avant-garde school. But in the 50s, it was USC mostly. And they were the ones who were breaking through and trying new things. And he and his friends, almost all of them, worked on The Exiles.
You mean people in Los Angeles who didn't want to go Hollywood?
Yes, and they had seen what they thought was Hollywood, pat stories, pat endings, and they wanted a film that just showed reality, that just had really no beginning and ending, but a sense of place and sense of community.
So even though it has a lot of staged scenes, the word documentary has still been applied?
Well, that's how they thought of it, and that's what they called it, and certainly in today's standards, you can call it that too, because there's so many documentaries that have recreations and all that. He knew it wasn't. He knew it was all staged. He helped write the script, but everything like Killer Sheep had been experienced by the people in the film.
Did you think of Killer of Sheep as a documentary on some level?
Well,
it really did feel real.
Well, I wanted it to look like a documentary. I wanted to someone looking at it would feel that I just placed the camera in the middle of the street and just filmed what was there. And I think he did somewhat the same thing.
What happened to Kent McKenzie after he made The Exiles? Did he make other movies?
He made a lot of short films in the 60s that are going to be brought out later on the DVD. He had some problems, like everybody has, especially when you want to be independent. He finally made another feature film called Saturday Morning, which was a documentary about kids in Los Angeles and facing sex and drugs and everything else. And it's actually a very good film. Columbia brought it out, and it got great critical acclaim, but it was quickly forgotten as well.
And then when did he die?
He died in 1980. He started getting tremors and started having seizures. And finally they gave him medication that just destroyed him.
Sherman, Kent McKenzie wasn't a Native American, was he?
No, he wasn't.
So what do you think, do we know about his motivation for creating the Exiles?
Well, certainly at that point, with that first generation of relocated Native Americans, which is what the movie is about, the people who were through a government program were left reservations and moved into cities for jobs. Los Angeles was one of the epicenters of that movement. So
he uses the word diaspora. Do you think that that's the right word to use?
It is. It is a perfect word. Los Angeles was filled, inundated quickly. So, you know, as artists, as writers, whatever we do, you know, we're going to work with the stuff we see. So I know that he must have seen the amazing influx of Native Americans into Los Angeles, and that was what inspired him.
And to a specific neighborhood, in fact, the Bunker Hill neighborhood, which doesn't exist anymore, does it? You live in L.A., Charles.
It's totally changed. And what struck me about the film is that I used to visit that area a lot because Grand Central Market was a big thing in our lives, you know, because we'd all go shopping at the Grand Central Market. And it was like nostalgia, looking at something that I've witnessed before. And
had you remembered that there was a trolley that
went up that hill? Yes. In fact, I was on it once. I rode on it.
And it was a favorite location for filmmakers at the time, and then it's totally been razed and gentrified?
Well, the start of the film really was in 1955 when the city council, which was close by, made a proclamation that they were going to level the area and make it into office buildings. And Kent's first student film was called Bunker Hill 1956, protesting the destruction of this wonderful community. It was the community of John Fante and Charles Bukowski, and it was poor and impoverished, but the Victorian mansions that were built in 1910 about around that time still existed, and it was a beautiful neighborhood. And so he wanted to film this area as a protest in his short, and then he wanted to show how beautiful it was in this film.
Ironically, when a film was made about Charles Bukowski, they had to recreate this neighborhood in Los Angeles, all with film sets. Do you know, Sherman, whether McKenzie had befriended the Native Americans he depicted in the film and consulted with them on the script?
Well, I certainly don't know the history like Dennis would, but I do know from the film and learning more about the film is that he was very collaborative. So he was very interested in telling the stories that his actors knew, his non-actors, actually. They're non-pros. So I do know that he showed a lot of respect to people's personal stories and made sure that was part of the film.
Well, at the time the film was made, wasn't the popular image of American Indians defined by movie westerns? Do you think that the people involved in this film hoped to change those perceptions?
The popular image of Native Americans is still westerns. That's what makes this film made decades ago still revolutionary, is that it still presents an alternative image that isn't very mainstream even now. So, I think that was certainly part of their artistic and political motive was to tell stories that hadn't been seen.
Unlike your film, Charles, this one uses voiceovers to convey the actors' internal monologues. There are two schools of thought about voiceovers in movie making. You do it or you don't do it. Mm-hmm. But do you think it works here?
I think it works perfectly. I mean, I was, it opens with Yvonne's story, and she's one of the principals in it.
Described as a new generation of Native Americans. Mm-hmm.
And she's very poignant in what she says. You know, I think everyone sort of reveals this sort of inner sort of dialogue. And it just captures, you know, the anxiety, the sort of alienation to some extent, you know. And I don't know if you could do that dramatically without extending it, you know, to a much longer film.
The cinematography is just gorgeous.
Brilliant, yeah.
Was that just because he had a brilliant cinematographer, or was the technology at the time improving?
I think it was the fact that he had an eye and a vision, and had good control of images, and he had a great several great photographers, I think. And black and white is such a special film.
You've done very well with black and white as well.
I wish to use it today.
And I should say that UCLA restored this, and they spent 2 years on it. And great films like Killer Sheep, and there's a lot of comparisons I can make with Charles's and Sherman's work, which is why we asked them to present it. But there's a physical reaction when you're in a theater watching a great film, and this film really, mm-hmm. you have such a physical reaction of excitement and joy watching it.
I'm talking with Dennis Doris, who's co-founder and vice president of Milestone Films, which is releasing The Exiles, a film made by Kent McKenzie in the late 50s and first actually presented in 1961, I think.
Yes.
Also with us are filmmaker Charles Burnett and novelist Sherman Alexie, who are presenting, putting their names on the film, adding their imprimatur. Sherman, McKenzie said that he hoped the film avoided the romance of poverty. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, you know, there's always that idea that poverty is supposed to teach you something. That notion that, you know, being poor means, you know, you're not prey to materialism, or there's always that notion that poor people are better.
And more noble.
Yes, exactly. So, poverty only teaches you how to be poor.
And I'm sure that's something you thought about as well, Charles, when you made your films.
Well, you know, you wanted to make a story about people, you know, and their daily lives and what they're going through, to sort of share it with the rest of the world, in a sense, you know, and not to be victimized, but to show the resilience and how they endure. And I think the film does that, you know, very well.
Dennis, what is the history of this film? Where was it first shown in 1961?
It was shown at the Venice Film Festival in 1961.
So it started off really,
really well,
at the highest level.
And it got some good brief comments from the press. And then it showed in the 1964 New York Film Festival, the very first one. And then the 1966 San Francisco Film Festival. But it never got any attraction from the distributors.
Now, why is that? Americans were already seeing Italian neorealist mm-hmm. films, and during this time, the French New Wave was becoming quite popular here. And it wasn't like we were unaware of this kind of film.
Well, Sherman might be able to better answer this, but it might just be the topic that they didn't want mm-hmm. to see a negative portrayal of a race that they didn't want to acknowledge.
Do you think that's the case, Sherman?
You know,
humanizing Native Americans.
We can't get movies distributed now, or made, or even financed. You know, Chris Ayer and I made Smoke Signals 10 years ago, which still remains the only film written and directed by Native Americans to ever receive national distribution. There's only been one movie like that that's ever even been seen in more than a handful of theaters at the same time. So that same problem persists. Nobody's really interested in realism about Native Americans.
Was there I wonder how he financed this film. That must have been difficult. Was he just asking friends for help?
It's interesting. He started off with $579. That was what he had in his bank account. And then he started asking some of the people he knew in the area. The barber that's in his short film, Bunker Hill, lent him, I think, $1,200. And he got the stock footage from the studios, the N-rolls of camera negative. And also Haskell Wexler put in $5,000 near the end when he desperately needed the money.
And he did rely a lot on his actors. The voiceovers are based mostly on interviews with them.
He had taken a tape recorder and interviewed them, and that became the monologues in the film. He wanted it to be authentic. He wanted it to be real, and he used those interviews as part of the film.
Charles, were you consulted when they were working on the restoration?
No, I wasn't. And, it wasn't needed. I mean, Ross Lippman is such a great person and a talent, you know, and that whole group just, you know, no, they do it by themselves.
But what happened when Killer of Sheep was restored?
Oh, well, that Ross is very good in keeping you in the loop, you know, and keeping you involved in it and things like that. And I looked at the grading of it and things like that, you know. And he was very good about trying to keep it just as it was in many ways, you know, and trying to get the right color, I mean, black and white, the right contrast and things like that. So the passion those guys have is just amazing.
Well, I want to ask all of you this. Why do you think films like this and Killer of Sheep come out, get a very nice critical response, don't really have the major breakthrough, and then many years later, people look at them and say, oh my, this is a revelation.
Oh, I'd like to think
is it because we've learned something over all the years since?
I'd like to think it's milestone, but in truth, I think
well,
it's
you
just,
are making it available.
I just think it's somebody standing up on the building and yelling and saying, see this film, and we've gotten – the press is really hungry for films that have a real content and real visceral feeling, and we've been lucky, very lucky that way.
But in your case, Charles, you must have felt frustrated over
No, not really, because what happened was I made it a student film, and it was never meant to be shown theatrically, except in a little small venues and things like that.
And you didn't know that you had made a masterpiece?
No, I'm sorry, I'm calling it a masterpiece. Thank you very much. But no, it was a student film. It was for my thesis film. And so I never bothered about getting the rights to the music, and I moved on. And then it screened at different places, got some awards in Europe and things. But it wasn't until Milestone came aboard that they saw the potential of it and passionately went about getting it, you know, to where it is now, you know. So it takes someone who has the know-how and the means to distribute the film and to do it well to get it out there.
So, Sherman, has this film been shown in the Native American – in any Native American communities?
No, not really. It's just starting to. And I've been getting a lot of phone calls from various Native organizations that want to do screenings and want me to be there, and certainly I can't do all of them. But it's starting to make its way into the Indian world now, and everybody that's seen it so far is going crazy for it because we haven't told the story of the relocated either as Native artists.
And the film seems to make no judgment or even come to a resolution at the end. Do we know what happened to the three main characters in The Exiles?
Homer died in 1982, but we have not been able to find anybody. We've done a fairly extensive search of all the records and going back to the tribes, but
so they could have stayed in Los Angeles. They could have gone back to the reservation.
Well, they were smoking, drinking, and getting in jail, so I don't know if their life expectancy was going to be expansive, but I'm hoping that we'll find them as we release the film.
What about the people who you filmed in Killer of Sheep? Have you been in contact with
them? Yeah, in fact, I was just at a 4th of July party with some of them. And a lot of them have passed on, you know, in almost the same situation as in McKinsey's film. Yeah, because most of them were friends of mine, and so we still stay in contact to some extent. For example, like Charles Bracer, I talk to him almost every day.
I think the real appeal of films like this, that they just seem so real, that you get the feeling, whether you call it a documentary, whether you call it a story film or whatever, that this is the way things really were. And that is an extraordinary accomplishment for a filmmaker to do. Nodding your head, Charles.
Oh, yeah, I do because, you know, I started off appreciating documentary films and observing people, and I like to look at real stories. And it's all about sharing culture and things like that. And this film does that. And other than in films that are purely concerned about entertainment, doesn't really serve you except for it to deflect what's really happening in the world.
Maybe we need a couple of explosions in it and then we can do better. The Exiles is being released by Milestone. What's happening now?
Well, because of the great reviews, I mean, we got a few more today. It's going to be playing in a lot of cities, at least 60, 75 around the country. It starts Friday at the IFC. And, of course, a lot of reservations do want to show it, and we want to work on that. And from there, I hope it's going to go internationally. We have dates already in Vienna and quite a few places.
The IFC on 6th Avenue.
Yes.
In Greenwich Village.
Where they showed Killer Sheep last year.
And it's going to be starting on the 11th?
It's opening Friday at the 11th, and Charles and I will be doing our touring appearances.
Mm-hmm. And Sherman, come to New York again. We miss you.
Oh, yeah, I will be back.
My thanks to Sherman Alexie, Charles Burnett, and to Dennis Doris for talking about The Exiles with us belatedly 47 years after it should have opened. It's been a real pleasure.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good.